it's really difficult to engineer freedom tech, like, you know, solutions that like require you to kind of take ownership of your money, take ownership of your data. These things, you know, typically have engineering solutions that are harder to build. They might take a longer time to build, or it might actually require the user to kind of learn something new, or requires just a new way of us thinking about product building. So it kind of ends up being this, you know, huge disadvantage in that regard.
Is there something inherent, and even maybe some would argue noble, I think, about self-sovereignty, freedom tech requiring friction? Stephen DeLorme, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sean.
I appreciate it. I love the ATL BitLab background. So how are things in maybe sunny Georgia?
Yeah, things are going great. Vibes are high at ATL BitLab as always. Just got another Bitcoin meetup in the lab here tonight. It's every single Wednesday night here. So things are going good, and just looking forward to 2026 and what the community will build.
Awesome. Yeah. And for anyone in Atlanta or the surrounding areas, definitely recommend you check out ATL BitLab. I'll be sure to have the links in the show notes. It is a great space with even greater people, which I've had the opportunity to spend some time in and with. So we are, if I am doing my calendar math correctly, Stephen, we're recording two days after Square's Bitcoin launch. And that is now available to 4 million merchants, in-person merchants. I'm not sure actually if that's what they call in person or in total. It is a product, as I've seen, and I want to get your take, with, you know, really strong UX, great design, fully custodial. And so I think the timing is perfect to, with you, explore the tension between the sort of purity of freedom tech, as it were, Bitcoin most specifically, and, you know, designing for freedom. And in that, people like yourselves, you're very much in the center of this, are taking into consideration what non-technical, everyday individuals want and need. And so, you know, with that, let's talk about sort of the seduction of you know, great product design and smooth UX. So Cash App, Venmo, even some custodial wallets, they are, I think, winning because the UX is just buttery smooth, you know, the user experience. And meanwhile, some self-custody tools can feel like operating a nuclear reactor. And so as a product designer, and let's take a moment as you answer to give us a bit of insight into your work. How do you think about this fundamental challenge or disadvantage that freedom tech comes out of the gate with?
Yeah. So I'll you know, briefly kind of summarize my experience in this space. And you know, I didn't really start off in freedom tech like most people. You know, I was just a graphic design major in college, spent the first part of my career doing mostly design, more focused on marketing and advertising and that sort of stuff. Of course, you kind of have to know some amount of building for the web to be, you know, competent these days as a designer. You know, we're in a digital first world now. So I kind of fell into web design, web development, and then, you know, kind of fell into freedom tech along the way there. And then kind of transitioned into product design from there. Did, you know, work with the Bitcoin design community under a Spiral grant. Now I work on product at Voltage from a design perspective. And it's a huge disadvantage for people building freedom tech, because I think for a couple of reasons. One, you have this idea that when you live somewhere like, let's say, the USA, where more or less your freedoms are respected, like, sure, everyone will have gripes here and there about something they don't like in their particular city or state, or, you know, something the president said or whatever. But by and large, we live in a place where, like, you know, your freedoms are more or less respected. And, you know, that's creates a situation where you don't really need freedom tech. Like, you can benefit from it, but you don't, like, need it the way that someone living under an authoritarian regime needs it right this second. You might need it one day, but right now you don't, like, need it to carry on your daily business. And then there's this other idea that I think it's just, it's really difficult to engineer freedom tech, like, you know, solutions that like require you to kind of take ownership of your money, take ownership of your data. These things, you know, typically have engineering solutions that are harder to build, or, you know, they might be harder to build. They might take a longer time to build, or it might actually require the user to kind of learn something new, or it requires just a new way of us thinking about product building. So it kind of ends up being this, you know, huge, you know, disadvantage in that regard.
Is there, in your view, Stephen, is there something inherent and even maybe some would argue noble, I think, about self-sovereignty, freedom tech requiring friction? What's your perspective on that?
Should self-sovereignty and freedom tech require friction? I don't think so. I don't think it has to involve friction.
So you don't buy that assertion, which I would assert many builders say, you know, is that in order to learn, you got to suffer.
Yeah. And I think people, it's kind of like the whole idea of like, there's a band that you go to listen to at your local club. And it's like, you know, it's a band, people from your community making music. And then, you know, one day they get a record deal, and then, you know, they get bigger and bigger. And then one day they're playing the Super Bowl and you're like, I don't like them anymore. I like them when they used to play in the clubs. Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, you know, there's this kind of idea that like, as something becomes more accessible, when you find something early on, you like it more because it's like, well, I had to work hard to find it. You know, I had to follow this one obscure Instagram account just to know when this band was playing, and everybody else has the benefit of finding them now on Spotify. I had to work to listen to this band. And I think there's very, and you can see this kind of thing happening in computing too, where it's like, well, I used to have to work to understand how to use computers. Now
I compiled my kernel
easier,
and now it just installs. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, I don't like that kind of like hipster mentality of, you know, just because something is more accessible, it's no longer good. I do think there are some interesting ideas though, like when it has been argued before that, you know, sometimes computer software maybe makes it too easy these days. And like the idea is that like in the 90s, you wanted to learn how to use a piece of software, you know, you would get a manual for how to use Adobe Illustrator that was like this thick. I mean,
absolutely.
It was like 3 inches thick for people
that
who were
section in the bookstore, you know, had those yeah. 20 pound tomes.
But the thing is you actually really, just by having this more mentality of like, well, I'm going to go read how to do it in the manual, I think you actually learned how to use the software at a much deeper level. So I do think there is some merit to sometimes with software just saying, look, if you want this piece of software to fulfill your purpose, for me, that might be graphic design, you need to educate yourself about how to use it. That's mm-hmm. going to make you a better, you know, a better, more powerful user of this piece of software. Having said that, I don't think every single software in the world needs to be to that degree. Like if you want to use a piece of design software and you want to just, you know, totally slay at, you know, making designs or making video or making whatever you're using in your particular piece of software, yes, you do need to kind of read the manual, go down the rabbit hole, so to speak, and really educate yourself. But I don't think every single piece of software, like certainly just a messaging app or visiting a website or sending money back and forth, I don't think that necessarily needs to be the friction. So I think it's more of a matter of like what kinds of software requires, you know, friction. I know I'm going on a little bit of a rant here.
No,
but
it's good.
Another way to think about it is maybe in terms of friction, maybe you don't want friction so much as you want slowness, right? And so, like, I think of friction as being like, well, it was really difficult. It was really confusing. I didn't know how to do it.
Right.
When I was using this particular piece of software, I got the impression that it was buggy or I didn't understand what it was telling me. That's what I think of when I think of friction. But, you know, if, you know, for example, like, let's say you're trying to onboard customers to some kind of multi-sig solution that's going to, you know, help them self-custody, like, you know, multitudes of Bitcoins, you might want that to be a slow experience. You might not want people to just download that thing and, you know, start using it immediately and just, you know, throw a caution to the wind.
Right.
You might want it to be a very slow onboarding, like, okay, we're going to onboard you to a solution for self-custodying your money. We don't want you to do this if you're in a coffee shop or if you're at a party or surrounded by lots of people.
This is not
we
a speed
want
run.
To be in a calm. Yeah, we want you to be in a calm environment, but you can still imagine it being a very like easy or kind of like handheld process. Of
right.
Like, this is going to take an hour to complete. It has 10 steps. Are you ready to begin? You can save your, you know, you can come back and and resume this later if, you know, you get interrupted. So you can make it a very calm, handheld, understandable process and make it kind of slow. And that in my mind is different than like friction, which I think of as like really kind of negative and harsh and confusing.
I think that is super interesting. So what I take from that is there is friction, for lack of a better word, and there's pace. And and I think that's really interesting because I think about patterns like, which are now, I believe, and hopefully are standard, requiring you to enter your seed phrase, you know, play it back to prove that you've recorded it, that you haven't just YOLO'd through a seed phrase, for example. And so from that, and you touched on this, let's talk about, you know, the cost of making it easy or too easy. So one of your projects, 12 Cash, makes sharing payment information very simple. But simplicity, you know, often means abstraction. Abstraction implies a certain level of trust. Where do you draw the line between simple enough to use and easy enough to fool you?
The distinction between simple enough to use and easy enough to fool you. Yeah, that's a good question, because I think, you know, we've seen certainly like controversies online as of late of like, you know, products that, you know, people felt confused by what was actually happening in the interface. I don't know. It's a very tough problem to solve. I think, you know, I mean, I really just think about it as in terms of trying to figure out who you're trying to build for.
Right.
Like I don't think you ever want to fool anybody.
Sure, of course.
That's a dark pattern, you know, in the UI world, we call those dark patterns.
Yes.
Where it's like when you're trying to cancel a gym membership or something like that, and they make the, you know, do you sure you want to cancel? And
right.
Then they make the cancel button, the no, keep my membership button, like the big, you know, primary solid color button that your eye, you know, gets drawn
yes.
to. So you don't want to fool anybody. You don't want like dark patterns or anything like that. I think just from a like moral perspective. But I think you really just got to think about like who you're building for and like, you know, what problem they're actually trying to solve. You know, you brought up the Square terminal earlier, and they're, you know, I don't think of like the Square product as being like for dissidents or unbanked
Certainly.
People
Certainly.
Or anything like that. It's really, they're just trying to solve a problem for like local businesses of like, you know, a coffee shop, for instance. Probably before they can afford the real estate for their coffee shop, they probably are pouring cups of espresso at a local farmer's market.
Right.
And previously they were an all cash business. Now, like with Square, they can like start accepting credit cards, right? And so like custody and all that is like totally acceptable for that kind of customer. They're not really operating in like a high friction environment. If you're building stuff that's like, you know, for human rights activists and stuff, you have to think about like all these other things about like they actually need custody of the money, because most, you know, banks and fintech providers won't even serve their country. You need to think about like, you know, being able to like hide the money and make plausible deniability in case they're like arrested or something
yes.
like that. So it's a completely different end of the spectrum. Voltage, a lot of the work that we're doing these days, we kind of, you know, I'll say like 2021, the narrative was very much run your own node, mm-hmm. right? Like run your own Lightning node. And a lot of businesses wanted to do that. But we've kind of, as we've gotten to know our customers better and gotten to know the kind of customers that want to learn about Bitcoin and start accepting Bitcoin, we started to learn that for a lot of them, like running a Lightning node wasn't really important to them. They just wanted to be able to accept Lightning payments.
Right.
And so for us, our solution to that problem is we're going to open a line of credit to your business and you can hit our API, send Lightning payments as much as you want, as long as you pay back your line of credit, you know, at the end of your billing cycle. And so, you know, I think it's just a matter of understanding what it is that your actual customers need before you, you know, start building. Because it's very easy from like a engineering, like I run into this myself. It's very appealing for me to want to build things that are like kind of technically fascinating and like scratch the technical itch in my brain. Even as a designer, I fall victim to that. But, you know, when you're thinking about it from like a product perspective, you really need to think about like who it is you're building for and like what solves the problem for them.
Yes. And I think as you were speaking, and I mean, kudos to you and the Voltage team. I think the line of credit, knowing many of you as I do, and having some insight into how the product has evolved, I think Voltage is a great example of meeting the market, meeting customers where they are. And it brings to mind this sort of slider, you know, between pure protocol sort of adherence and self-sovereignty and user experience and customer needs and wants. And I know it's very difficult. And it's an ongoing process to sort of dial that in, as it were. Well, let me ask about maybe a few more specifics, Stephen, and those are great backdrops. You touched on the pace and needing to sort of slow down the intense, potentially, you know, high value, high risk flows of something like custodying your money, multi-sig, for example. Are there other areas where friction is positive, beneficial? And again, it's my word, not yours, but that sort of not hiding all the details, so sort of surfacing some of the complexity. And so that's sort of part A, you know, where are there patterns or areas where you see that as necessary and positive? And with it, Are there advice or cautionary notes you could offer to people about being more aware of some of those dark patterns? So, you know, where is there a positive application of what I would call friction, and where instead are we sort of seeing these dark patterns that are designed to fool the end user?
Well, I don't think I see a lot of dark patterns in like Bitcoin and freedom
But, so much. The alternatives, right? Because, the alternatives.
Yeah. I would say, in terms of the freedom tech world, where like friction might be good, like some would argue that fees, maybe, like, you know, if you just want like more transparency over fees, you know, I kind of don't know. I kind of don't worry about that nearly as much, just because I feel like, at least from a Lightning perspective, I think a lot of the times the fees are so low that you know, don't really run into an issue. But I, you know, totally, if you're running some kind of service like, I don't know, like a wallet that accepts on-chain and Lightning, and there's like some kind of conversion happening there, you could certainly run into a situation where, like, you know, converting between Lightning and on-chain could like maybe create some unexpected fee.
Right.
So I guess
you're doing a swap
now
or something.
Kind of work. Yeah. I guess as I work this out, as I talk about it, I think that could be a place where maybe a little more, you know, a slower pace or friction might be warranted, and that like, you don't want to, like, it's very convenient to feel like, oh, it just kind of all magically swaps into whatever format the user's requesting. But if that swap is going to like eat up like 25% of the value of whatever it is, it's like, yeah, you might want to caution them and make them aware of that.
Right.
I think, you know, when it comes to stuff like Nostr, actually, you know, you know, a lot of people are trying to like onboard everybody at Noster very quickly and all that kind of stuff. And I guess it kind of depends on your perspective of Noster. I'm a little bit of a black sheep when it comes to Noster, and I think about it a little bit differently. But, you know, there's this one kind of philosophy of Noster that's like, oh, like your Noster key is going to be like your self-sovereign identity. And, you know, you're going to use this for all of your Noster applications to represent your identity. Well, if that is your philosophy of how Noster works, then you probably want a little bit of a slower paced introduction, I think, because you don't want people making this identity and then losing it.
Right.
There's also the more ephemeral view of Noster, which I tend to lend myself more towards, which is like the kind of bit chat version of Noster, where you're actually not even aware that you're using Noster.
Yes.
And you download BitChat, and it's this like kind of ephemeral identity. Like there's not this illusion with BitChat that you're going to be like using the same identity every single time you log on. And so with that regard, it's actually very easy to just onboard people quickly. You don't need that friction with that kind of philosophy of Noster. But yeah, I think it's really just those kinds of things where you're going to like cause somebody to lose money, or you're asking them to create an identity or something like that. I feel like those really lend themselves to a slower, more handheld pace. But yeah, I mean, the kind of like dark patterns I think we want to avoid are, we want to like avoid, in the regular world, that's stuff like you're trying to cancel something and you're trying to trick somebody into not canceling it, or you're tricking people into upgrading to a new member, like a higher level of membership towards something, or you're trying to opt people into sharing their data. Like,
right.
You automatically have the box selected that says, yes, please add me to your marketing list and share my personal information with your advertising network.
Right. Like, or I think of Venmo, you know, which I think the social aspects, and I haven't been on in years, so I'm not qualified to say what it looks like these days. But there was this playfulness about sharing, you know, as many would joke, it's like, I know who you pay rent to and who your weed dealer is, you know, because it's all out there. And so are there, I don't know that you spent a lot of time looking at this, Stephen, but in payments specifically, do you see much of that going on, and that, you know, individuals should be wary of?
I think with Venmo, I just don't get it. I've never used it. I refuse to download it. And I know it's very popular among my generation, but I never understood the appeal of like, I'm going to like have all my payments like broadcast publicly. That just seems kind of weird. I don't know if I would call that a dark pattern, I guess, just because I guess people are aware of it. And I guess people like it.
Yeah. And it's, you know,
I don't get it.
Yeah, it's not for us to convince someone that they should or shouldn't do anything, but I think it is worthwhile to call out, and I believe this is fair, correct me if you disagree, that in traditional sort of TradFi payments, you know, you are the product in many ways. There's a vig on the payment, you know, they're making some money on the payment, but the data, to use the cliche, is the new oil, where I think what Bitcoin offers you in most cases is anonymity, if not total privacy.
Yeah, if you're using it right. I would say I can speak to that a little. I mean, what Please. A lot of people don't realize is, like, it's scary how much, you know, data about you is already being sold through, like, credit and debit cards and stuff like that. I remember before I moved into Freedom Tech, and I'd say this is probably a catalyst for, you know, my kind of transition to Freedom Tech, is I used to do a lot of marketing and advertising for like B2B tech stuff. Not the kind of stuff you'd see on TV usually, because like I said, more B2B kind of stuff. But I had to work on like marketing videos for so many products that are like deployed at, you know, large enterprises that are really just about this, about like, you know, collecting large amounts of data on people, trying to come up with insights about, you know, individuals and what they might buy. And I mean, get this, one time I had to work on a video that was not even, get this, it wasn't even, it was not never going to be seen by end users. It was never going to be seen even as a business market, like advertising to other businesses. This was a video designed to pitch a single data analytics idea to some executives at a very large soft drink company that everyone probably drinks. And so and I was like looking at all the people in the room working on the video with me, good people, all of them, good designers to work with. But I'm like looking at it and I'm like trying to calculate, like, well, we've been working on this for a couple weeks now. And I'm like, wow, this video probably has a budget of at least $30,000. This was probably a budget of $30,000 to make a video designed to pitch an idea to like a group of five people. And that's how much money
right.
is in data and analytics. It is such a like profitable money machine that, you know, dropping $30,000 just to pitch the idea to a group of five people is totally worth it in their book. And I worked on the other project for a company that all they do is hook into they partner with banks and say, give us all the data about your customers' financial transactions. And then we will find advertisers who want to advertise to them. And we'll kind of like do like a matchmaking operation between that. And a lot of major banks that everybody knows the names of actually, you know, are customers of this company.
And it is routine, right? And I think that's the thing that is worth taking away among great points there. You know, if anyone wants to try this out, sign up for one of these services that automates the process of getting your data removed from brokers and it getting them to stop collecting. I use one in particular. I'll remember what it is at some point. I've been enrolled for about 6 months and they're at 900 data brokers and counting that have my data
wow.
that they're removing me from, so they say, I believe. And many will not agree to a checkbox that says, you know, don't start again. They will start again, and I'll have to do this process continually. So all that to say, it is remarkable what a massive industry that is behind the scenes, and that is the de facto with not just payments apps, but certainly financial services stand to gain the most. Well, on that note, Stephen, let's talk more about Square. So as we said, they rolled out Bitcoin payments to millions of merchants. I don't know about you. I took a look. Someone floated their onboarding video, their merchant-facing onboarding video. Looked quite straightforward to me. What's your read? Is this how Bitcoin wins? Is it a necessary step in turn? Yeah, so please.
Probably how Bitcoin wins. Yeah, I mean, it's just one more step in Bitcoin, you know, gaining the mass adoption that, you know, a lot of people in the Bitcoin industry are crazy for. I think it's a great move, actually. I think the problem with trying to onboard merchants to Bitcoin before, it's a couple problems with it. Like, one, when a lot of times when Bitcoiners go at this narrative of, you know, we're trying to fix inflation and like, oh my God, every problem in our society is caused by inflation. Yeah. And they're like, dude, I'm just trying to pour coffee for people and like, you know, make ends meet at the end of the month. Like and so you got to meet, I think, business owners where they're at and what they're trying to do is they're trying to get customers, they're trying to retain customers, and they're trying to lower their expenses too. With the fee model,
absolutely,
like the really like low fee model, like that's huge. Another kind of problem with onboarding merchants before was, just like we've talked about, like the friction with kind of self-custodial wallets. Even if that business owner, if you can kind of, you know, convince them like, yeah, you know, you should download the self-custodial wallet, and they might use it for their own personal uses. But it's a much more complicated matter to like onboard a business where you might be hiring somebody to, you know, work in your coffee shop, to continue this example, who you don't know very well. You count the cash register at the end of the night, right? Like that's just typical for any business. You can't just have a situation where like, you know, everybody, you know, every person you hire for your business has access to the self-custodial Bitcoin. And, you know, I know there's certainly great solutions like BTC Pay Server and all that, but typically there's just been, it's been kind of hard to onboard people. And there's been a lot of, you know, community initiatives around the world to like onboard people, like, oh, we're going to go out to businesses and try and, you know, convince them to accept Bitcoin. But you got to think about it. It's kind of like you're trying to onboard them to a self-custodial Bitcoin wallet. Who's the tech support for that business? That has always been, that's why I've in the past have never like really tried to do much community outreach here in Atlanta, because it's like, I'm a busy guy. I don't want to do tech support. Like one-on-one, I'm happy to like talk to, you know, people and answer the questions about Bitcoin. But like, I don't want to get into a situation where like me and my friends are like kind of like free tech support.
Absolutely.
For yeah. local businesses.
We do that for
so,
our families.
Yeah, the Square
already
thing is
enough.
Yeah, exactly. The Square thing is great because it's like it meets them where they're at in terms of fee savings. And it also is kind of like bundled into a service that already has tech support. And I can, on that note, by the time this podcast drops, I'm sure the announcement will already be out there. So there's kind of an initiative.
We're publishing today, so be
Haley
careful. if it's
not. No, I think it's okay. The tweet is supposed to go out this morning.
Great.
So Haley Burko and Matt Bayless from Spiral have been working on this kind of like merchant adoption initiative. And so a lot of the Bitcoin community spaces around the world are helping. ATL BitLab's involved. I think both of the Bitcoin parks and the space are involved, and probably some other ones that I'm forgetting at the moment. We basically have like these, you know, Bitcoin plushies, like, you know, the grumpy Bitcoin, the Here Comes
that
Bitcoin.org.
Explains the box of them that I saw at Bitcoin Park last night.
Exactly. Okay. So we got a bunch of boxes here too. And so we're starting a movement. So we're sending out an ATL BitLab street team with plushies and onboarding letters to try and onboard our favorite businesses. And the kind of letter, it's actually very cute and adorable. It's kind of like written from the perspective of the grumpy
Love
Bitcoin.
It.
And it's like, why am I grumpy? It's like, because I'm grumpy because of 3% credit card fees.
Nice.
And it's just like the whole like, you know, campaign they've started is really like meeting merchants where they're
right.
at, which is not like talking about
liquidity,
inflation,
or,
and freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, hey, if you're already a Square merchant, you can turn this option on. If you're not a Square merchant, we can help you with that. But like,
right.
if you're already a Square merchant, you can turn it on. You can save money on fees, and that'll be great. And so we're going to start some more stuff at BitLab here, just in terms of like, if some of these merchants have questions, we can have like a merchant night or something, where people, like a merchant town hall. But by and large, we'll probably just be driving people to the Bitcoin merchants like Facebook group. And that's really just like meeting merchants where they're at, solving a problem for them. So yes, I think Square, and answer your question, I think what Square is doing is great. And it's just kind of another little, you know, another little domino that gets tipped. We'll see who's next.
Love it. Well, and in fact, on that note, who else would you give accolades perhaps to, Stephen, who you think is balancing usability with trust or permissionlessness, if we want to sort of put that on the other end of the spectrum? Who's doing a good job of striking that balance?
Wow, that's a good question. I wonder else who is striking permissionlessness and trust. Like, I would say in terms of my favorite products, and is this Bitcoin specific or just broadly freedom?
Broadly. Anything you care to draw attention to?
My favorite one that I like, people have always heard me talk about, is Signal. I think that just I compare most Freedom Tech products against Signal.
Absolutely.
Because I've been using them for 8 years, and I think I'll probably still be using them for 8 years. And I think just in terms of being easy to onboard people to, I've never really had to hold anybody's hands much. I can basically just tell them somebody to download the app and then message me on it. It's built in such a way to where it actually doesn't really expose private keys, It really, you know, kind of stores it in the phone's enclave and keeps it kind of hidden so that the user doesn't have a foot gun. They can't accidentally shoot themselves in the foot and expose their key material. So that one has just been like a true blessing. And, you know, you're talking about balancing permissionlessness and trust, like they can't read your messages. It does rely on some centralized, like, kind of signal coordination servers. And, you know, it, in that regard, I guess that is a, you know, single point of failure, which isn't great. But I think that we've seen a pretty good track record of good behavior on terms of like the signal, like found and like just being run by a nonprofit foundation, I think is a pretty good model. So I think that like it's really, really easy from like an engineering standpoint to kind of become fascinated with decentralization and be like, we need everything decentralized and we need everything distributed. And I don't really know if that's a good way to think about it. I think it's a more of a model of like, well, what kinds of things need to be decentralized?
Right.
What kinds of things need to be distributed and how much do they need to be so? And so when we talk about Bitcoin nodes, if we talk about like Bitcoin being this like source of money for the world, like, yes, obviously we want Bitcoin to be as decentralized, you know, decentralized AF, but and we want like, you know, decentralized Bitcoin nodes at all costs. But when we think about other kinds of technology, it's like you may actually get to a point where too much decentralization actually makes it like, you know, just like, you know, ungodly hard to use. So I think Signal strikes that balance. They just like, they focus solely on like, we want it to be private. We want it to be, we don't want there to be user foot guns. We'll accept a little bit of centralization trade-offs. We just want it to be super private, super easy, no user foot guns. So I think that they do that very well. In terms of, you know, like Unchained is another product I'm a fan of.
Absolutely.
On the Bitcoin side. It's like, you know, they're their whole thing is they'll like, look, we're centralized. We can, you know, obviously if we are part of your multi-sig quorum, we can see your money. So they don't really they don't really focus so much on like the, you know, privacy side, I feel like, but they do focus on like this core idea that like, we will not custody your money. Like, you know, and if you do want to enter into like some kind of loan agreement with us or whatever, we're going to have like a third party have one of the keys. They're very, very good
yes.
at that. So I think it's just like a really like an idea of trying to figure out like what is like the core value and like the most important part of your product. For Signal, it's privacy. For Unchained, it's like we want to encourage self-custody. You know, at Voltage now, we, you know, our kind of, you know, efforts mostly now is like easy engineering integration and interoperability, right? So like for us, we're focusing more on making it easy for engineering teams to adopt, and we're focusing on making it interoperable with any other, you know, Bitcoin and Lightning service. You know, that's kind of where our focus is right now. So I think it's like, you know, some of my favorite products are just the ones that really, really know what the thing is that they're trying to optimize
and
for
whom,
and
as
just
you said
really
earlier,
hard
right?
into that.
Yeah, yeah. Know your audience, know your customer. Great points. And I'm big fans of both. And I think it's interesting. And Signal does deserve tremendous accolades and credit. They are the one most everyone, you know, starts with because they're such a shining example. So shout out to Signal and everyone I think should be using it.
And another product I can think of from a Freedom Tech perspective that I think does a really great job is Proton and just the whole suite of Proton services, Proton Mail, Proton Calendar, Proton Drive. And I do not get paid to shill them, though I kind of wish they would reach out and,
nice.
Because I feel like
yeah,
I shill them so
both.
Much. I started as a Proton Mail user when it was like really kind of rough around the edges and just stuck with it. And it's been so impressive to see their whole product stack and kind of similar to, you know, Signal, they've isolated what it is that they want to optimize around, which is privacy. And, you know, you have that centralization, thing right there, but they're not optimizing for decentralization. They're optimizing for privacy. And I think that just
yes.
goes to show that from a business perspective, you know, there is business models around Freedom Tech, but I think you just can't go into it trying to, you know, tick every single box on day one. You can't be like, we are going to be private. We are going to be decentralized. We are going to be peer-to-peer. We're going to be interoperable. Like you can imagine like all these different metrics you could try and optimize for. And it's really, really, really difficult to optimize for all of those. And when you do like Proton and you choose to just optimize for like one or two things, you can really make a ton of progress as a product and actually get like long-term sustainable customers. So yeah, find your core value and optimize for that is my take.
Yes, agree completely. And I think when you, and I'm also a longtime Proton user, and they, if I'm not mistaken, have 100 million users. So it is remarkable the scale that they've reached with privacy as the primary selling point. And they remind me, as some others do, that, you know, long ago, Google, their mantra was don't be evil. And that has long since been struck from all documentation, websites, and the like. But I think Proton and Unchained in their own way are examples of a bigger, better commitment, which is can't be evil, right? Unchained, and I'm a client, delighted client, great team, know so many of them, big fan, not taking any money. So just to say that that they're a great product and a great company, you know, they can help you, they cannot materially harm you. So if they were compelled, as you said, they could disclose some details, but they cannot take control of funds. Proton, while centralized, because of the way, you know, they're very, in my mind, sound cryptography works, you do lose some features. You know, I can't easily integrate Proton Calendar into some slick, you know, native desktop app, but they cannot see my data. They cannot, as you know, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but they can't be evil in that regard, which I think is a great shout out to them. If we then transition, Stephen, to what I think I understand that you and other product designers, UX designers, human computer interface discipline would study is psychology. And so with this, I'm curious, when someone makes the choice to use Cash App, and that is not a slam on Cash App, it's a great product. When they choose that over, say, a self-custodial wallet, let's just pick Blitz, you know, as a fine example. Not at the technical level, but what's your understanding at the sort of human level, the psychological level? What's the story behind why they make the choice they make? Is it as simple as one is easier, one is harder, or is there more to it?
I think why someone would use Cash App versus a self-custodial one would depend on, well, like, how are they approaching Bitcoin from the start? Like, you know, if they're not a Cash App user and they're not like, let's say they don't have Cash App and they also don't have a Bitcoin wallet. They're starting completely from scratch. You know, it might be that they choose Cash App just because it lets them buy Bitcoin. I mean, that's a huge thing that I think a lot of wallets ignore, is just acquiring Bitcoin. It's I know it's very appealing, this idea to like get Bitcoin in a peer-to-peer capacity. But you know, when people are thinking about it more from like an investing use case or a savings use case, they need to actually get Bitcoin. And so it's really, I think for one, it's just a features standpoint. Cash App lets you buy
Bitcoin. Can't use it if you don't have it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so a lot of wallets, it's kind of this cold start problem. It's like, well, yeah, you can download this wallet and there's no KYC and all that. But it's like, what do? I just like look at the number zero. Another way to look at it might be that like maybe it's they already were a Cash App user. And it's like, well, yeah, I could download, you know, this other wallet, but I already have Cash App. I think there's very much a sense of like app fatigue nowadays of like, I don't want another app.
Great point.
And this is like among technical and non-technical people. There's just this fatigue with more services and apps and websites you have to register for. And so I think for a lot of people, it's just like, well, I already have Cash App. Why not just use that? And
You know, that's an interesting, sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say that, you know, I had this aha moment, which is perhaps should be obvious given that I work in tech and have my whole career, is, you know, what struck me as you said that is the preciousness increasingly of the real estate on a user's phone. And so if you've got an install, what I hear you say is there's going to be a natural incentive to keep adding features so that the user doesn't turn to a different competitive app. It's like, let me jam everything in there, which is the you know, the sloppy way to do it. But in effect, once I've got a user, let's retain that user and serve them with every possible feature we can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of funny because a lot of times in UI design in the West, we're like, we have this tendency to want to make things as simple as possible. And like, if you look at like the evolution of software design from like over the past 30 years, it's gone from interfaces with like, you know, full plane control, you know, cockpit
right.
kind of situations to just being like, here's a screen with a single sentence and one big blue button. And it's like, that's like, and like, so we like that in the West, but it's funny if you look at UI design from like China and Vietnam and places in Asia, it's completely the opposite. They love that like cockpit, you know, kind of thing. And it's like a different psychology. It's kind of like WeChat, very popular in China. And it's like, there's this idea that like this one app handles all of your needs. It's like more of this comforting idea that like everything I need is right here. It takes care of me. And it's not just like actually chatting. It's also like a wallet. It's also a map. Like it's like Google Maps. So it would be like if your Venmo, your, you know, iMessage, your Google Maps, Yelp, everything was just like all bundled into one interface. But that's been a very like, you know, good business model for WeChat. You know, anyways, that's more of a tangential thing. There's just this really big difference. But
I think what, you know, here again, what strikes me, and I'm sure there are papers on this all over the place, but it seems that there might be a correlation between a more collectivist society and, as you, I think your words, Stephen, take care of me, you know, do it for me. And the rugged individualists that we like to believe we are in the U.S., which is, no, that's okay. I'll pick and choose. And that would translate into, you know, that device that we carry around with us all day long.
That very well could be. I think that might be part of it. I mean, we definitely have kind of a, you know, with the history of capitalism in this country, there's almost like a personal identity wrapped up in brands. And like, this is the thing is like when people really, really like a brand, they start to like kind of identify with that brand, kind of like how I'll wax poetic about, you know, Proton. We identify with products and brands that kind of not only we enjoy using, but also that we feel like match our values.
Yes.
And like who, what we stand for. And I know, and it's, and like, it's easy to say those kinds of things when we're talking about freedom tech, but this even like, you know, comes down to things like fast food brands and all of that. And I remember seeing this like meme online a long time ago. I mean, it was some like really stupid meme, but it was like this like guy being like, you know, what are you doing going to Chipotle and Moe's and places like that to get a burrito? Like Taco Bell was there for you with like that value meal and all of that. And it was like, but it's true. It's like people have these like emotional connections with things. And like, you know, for somebody, it might be that like, yeah, I remember like that Taco Bell value meal when I was in college and didn't have any money. That was dope. So, you know, we form these kinds of things. And so, you know, if you can, you know, bring somebody into your kind of product vision with like not only the product that you are actually giving them and the value you're giving them, but also like the kind of vision of the world and how you make them feel about it, you can really kind of form a relationship. And you know, you don't want to abuse that relationship, but once that relationship is in place, that opens up the door for you to make all kinds of other kinds of products for those people, keep that customer engaged.
Yes. And I think that is such an interesting and important point to make, which is, and I don't want to be a hypocrite because as I have told anyone who will listen to me and have said many times on the podcast, that after owning an iPhone since 2007 and having Macs since the 90s, I made a switch to another product plug for that, you know, no money's exchanged hands, but Framework laptop and a Pixel 9 running Graphene. So those are my two go-to devices. And so, you know, I sort of purposely broke out of the Apple ecosystem. And my point to all that being, they as a business have done brilliantly. I have bought a frightening amount of their products. But I think the nefariousness, be it designed or incidental, is as those products become more like appliances and as the experience just becomes smoother and easier and more fully integrated, it's just so easy to do the next thing, you know, with Apple, or to use the next Apple app that they probably have stolen the concept from some third-party independent app developer and now integrated into the operating system and so on and so forth. And so, you know, that is a rambling lead up, Stephen, to, you know, what would you say to someone nodding along to most of this, that yes, you know, Venmo's fun, even though it exposes my data. Apple is incredible, even though the iPad is an appliance that I can't really, you know, get under the hood and do anything with. Mm-hmm. What, if anything, is your call to action to people to get a little more uncomfortable? You know, what's, or would you? You know, what are those conversations like that you might have with an individual at ATL BitLab or on the street or, you know, at Chipotle?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, like, it's kind of like, how do you turn somebody on to Freedom Tech? And I don't know if I know the great answer to that.
If there is one, you're retired tomorrow.
Yeah, that's the thing. Because it's like, I find that people become most interested in these things when something bad happens to them. And I guess my personal experience has been that a lot of times people just don't care until something bad happens. Now, you have the kind of the nerd, the engineer kind of person who, you know, is just intuitively interested in these things. And because they want to know how something works under the hood, there's a whole class of, because I also help my friend Jordan out with his show, The Sovereign Computing Show, where he talks a lot of, like, very, very much in depth about these things. And it's kind of interesting as we dive into topics on that show. You know, there's a lot of people who are just like, yeah, I want freedom. There's also a whole class of person who's interested in, like, self-hosting just from a, like, kind of academic
curiosity
perspective. Someone who's just like, I want to set up a home network and self-host all this stuff just because, you know, I'm curious and I took a networking class and I can. Yeah. And so I think for that kind of class of person, kind of, you know, your kind of pitch is just like, you know, it's the hackable money wallet, or it's the hackable mail client. It's the hackable messaging thing. It's something that you can, you know, you're almost kind of like pitching it as almost like a toy to them.
Sure.
Because even though it is useful, it kind of is like the, you know, the saying, the bigger the boys, the bigger the toys. I don't mean to gender that, but it's
my mind. Sorry. I was, you know, we used to crack open the hood on the Mustang. You know, the engines are not so accessible anymore, but technology is. Sorry, please continue.
Yeah, so exactly. It's like, so for people who enjoy, you know, just like the tinkering, that is the allure of Freedom Tech, is that this stuff is built in a way that you can tinker with it. For everybody else, though, for the people who are not, you know, garage tinkerers and, you know, self, you know, PC hobbyists and all these things, I really find that people need something bad to happen before they get, and that doesn't mean catastrophically bad.
No, but like, you know, there's a privacy breach every other day, right? And I often think about that.
So they need to be like, in the headlines, Equifax got hacked again, let's say, for example. And then it's like, click here to find out if you were on the list. Oh, crap, I was on the list. What do I do? And then people get interested in that, or like, someone hacked into my email. And like, okay, well, now you need to get into password management.
Right.
Although, it might be like...
I wonder, you know, and I'll get your take on this. if there's not a fatigue there. You know, the credit agencies, ironically named, have so little credit with, I think, the average individual, that breach, that yet another breach is almost like, all right, so I get 6 months of free credit reporting and God knows what's going to happen to my data, delete, you know. So I say that to sort of prompt, do you think it's ratcheting up? Does it have to be catastrophic in order for someone to make a significant change?
It might have to be, but I hope not.
Yeah.
Like,
certainly.
Definitely, you're right. There is a bunch of fatigue and there are like an overwhelming number of people. I mean, I hear this opinion all the time when people are just like, I don't care. They have all my data.
Yeah.
They're tracking my every move. And I don't like that attitude a lot.
But it is there.
I'm just kind of like, yo, like toughen up. Like, you know, like you don't want, like, you're not like,
don't surrender don't wanna, that easily. Like,
fight. Yeah. One thing I do find is one of the best things in a kind of twisted way to steer people towards freedom tech is politics. And I've kind of told this story on another podcast before, but I'll retell it here. One of my favorite, you know, things about like privacy tech is that our opinions about privacy tech in the U.S. totally depend on who's president. Like, I remember, being like in high school and it's like George W. Bush was president, you know, everyone was still kind of sore about the, the name is blanking on me, but the act Congress passed right after 9/11.
Right, right.
But, you know, anyways, basically there was, you know, all these controversies in the 2000s over like, you know, is the government doing warrantless wiretaps? You know, what sorts of powers does the federal government have now to combat terrorism? Can that be deployed against, U.S. citizens? And the privacy narrative I was hearing in that time in the 2000s was totally about, it was totally coming from the left in the U.S. It was a democratic center-left idea that, like, maybe we should be more private, maybe we should be more concerned about the government's intrusion in our lives. And, you know, the center-right perspective was, no, we need to combat terrorism because terrorists suck. I think they're both valid viewpoints, but my point is, and I mean, certainly everyone has different individual takes, but during that time, I heard coming more center-left.
Yes.
Then, Obama gets elected, and then the scandal, like the Snowden, you know, scandal and all that, and then everyone on the right is suddenly more like, this happened under Obama's watch. You know, mm-hmm. We have this federal, federal apparatus, you know, surveilling our every move. And everyone on the left was like, no, you can't critique Obama.
Never let a good crisis go to waste, I think is the...
Exactly. Then Trump gets elected the first time. And suddenly everyone's like, oh my God, we need to get journalists using Signal. We need everyone using Signal so that people can exfiltrate information from the White House and, you know, bring down the fascist hierarchy mm-hmm. or whatever. Then suddenly, you know, January 6th happens, and then, you know, all of a sudden everyone on the right and like every Republican in my life is just like, Stephen, how do I get on Signal so that, like, you know, I don't want to get banned. I don't want the government.
I'm
like, dog, chill. And now we're right back. I mean, the pendulum, this pendulum just totally swing. And I don't mean to make fun of anybody for their politics here. My point is just that, like, privacy is a concern no matter who is in office.
It is like, apolitical political, if you wish to view it that way.
Yeah. And everything is political. But yes. What I mean is privacy shouldn't be seen as a partisan. It shouldn't be seen as part, because politics is who gets what.
Yes.
But partisan is like, you know, which party are you aligned with? And privacy doesn't need to be a partisan idea. You're always at risk of having your privacy breached. It's just that how we feel about privacy depends on who is the president in the U.S. at least. And I don't really know how to shake that belief in people. But the useful thing is that every 4 years, as the pendulum swings, we get a new crop of people interested in privacy tech. So, that's what I mean is like, it's not a catastrophic crisis, but in their mind, politically, it's a partisan crisis to them. And so, it kind of stirs their interest. So maybe as the pendulum swifts, more and more people become interested in privacy. And more people become interested, the products become hopefully easier to use and less evil. So that's kind of my optimistic take on it.
I love it. Let's with all of that wrap up here, Stephen. Uncomfortable question. What if most people prefer beautiful surveillance over ugly freedom, you know, and not to cast all freedom tech in that vein, but if it's the perspective is sort of on those two poles, if that's true, like what are we building for? Is it the 1% who care, or do you think we've got a shot at broader adoption of freedom tech?
I think that there's definitely a trend where people just want the as you put it, the beautiful surveillance over the ugly freedom, but it doesn't have to be that way. I think freedom tech products can be beautiful in terms of having beautiful interfaces. Part of that is, you know, helping, you know, projects, you know, helping freedom tech projects to care about, like, kind of having beautiful interfaces. Part of it is getting designers interested in working on these projects, which is always the challenge. But that's one part of the equation. I think, though, that it can also be kind of a Trojan horse type of scenario where if you build a product that's useful for other means, then it doesn't, like, you can work these freedom tech things in there in meaningful ways. So, like, for example, like what Square is doing with onboarding, you know, with Bitcoin support. Well, you know, it's custodial, but they're like onboarding a ton of merchants.
Yeah,
and that opens the door for merchants. Yeah, it opens the door. You know, stuff like Signal and Proton makes privacy more accessible. I think, you know, the more products we have that try to work this stuff in here, the better. And I guess this would really be a good place to highlight that I've heard people kind of like a lot of people like think of me as like, okay, I'm a product designer. I really try to think of myself these days as more as like, I'm a Bitcoin UX guy. I like to think about these things, not just from a design perspective, but also from an engineering perspective, because I think that good user experience is not just a design problem. I think that user experience is, you know, it's a problem to solve. Some UX problems have design solutions and some have engineering problems.
Great point.
Like some have engineering solutions. And so like sometimes it's just about like working until we have the optimal engineering solution to make this stuff easier to use. I mean, definitely all the work around with secure enclaves and stuff like that is a great start. So there's design solutions, there's engineering solutions. It's not always just about like making the interface more beautiful to use. Like, for example, you shared with me you know, some of like your master UX research that you were doing. And I liked that, you know, what you had in that document was not just, oh, it doesn't look pretty enough. It was that you're actually going into like under the hood. The problem with some of these Nostr products is that they're, you know, from an engineering perspective, they're like you had a page on there just about they're like waiting to display a list of results until they've queried every relay in their stack. That's an engineering problem.
Right.
And,
absolutely.
You know, so we just, you know, we have to, you know, get more freedom tech people interested in product, and we have to get more product people interested in freedom tech. But, you know, I'm overall optimistic that we can, you know, work freedom tech into every aspect of people's lives in a way that even if they don't know that it's there, it benefits them.
LFG. That is fantastic. That is the place to put it. Thank you so much, Stephen. Really appreciate it. And I do want to thank you specifically for all the work you do, Bitcoin Design Guide, the community that you, I know, at least co-lead, if not initiated. in Discord and elsewhere. These are really important initiatives, great contributions. So thank you for that. Thanks for the time today.
Well, I want to go ahead and actually on that point, thank you. And I want to go ahead and clear some things. So I did not start Bitcoin Design. It was you know, a group of designers on the internet who started it actually before me. I think, you know, Daniel Nord and Christoph Ono were some of the earliest ones there. Now the kind of community is kind of led mostly by Christoph and Mageshni. So unfortunately, I don't, you know, contribute to the design community as much as I used to did. But I'm kind of getting back into the swing of things a little bit. We have a project at Voltage now called the Bitcoin Builder Kit, where we're trying to kind of componentize. It's an open source project we're kind of doing in public in the design community, where we're trying to kind of, you know, componentize some aspects of Bitcoin UX so that other product teams can use this stuff and also make it easier for AIs to consume some of this stuff.
Very interesting.
But yeah, anyways, I just wanted to make
thank you.
Where it's due there.
Please, thanks for the correction and thanks to the other team members. And I will look forward to checking that out.
Yeah, common misconception because I'm one of the Bitcoin designers in the U.S. and so
yes.
I end up at conferences more and
right,
so
right. You're the face or a
people
face.
People sometimes assume yeah. At least in the U.S., I right. ended up several years ago being like the face, but it's like a whole global initiative.
It is yes, and thank you for that. And it's important. Yeah. And I think you know it's a good cautionary note that we don't assume that all of this stuff just happens stateside. Well, thanks again, Steve, and I'll get all those links out so people who are interested can dig in. And I think you have left, you know, from an engineer, a product designer, to an individual who just wants to pay, as you say, you know, the barista for their coffee. There's a lot to take away here, and I appreciate it. Hope to catch up and talk with you soon, Steve. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sean. It's been fun.
Bye-bye.